Okay, so what if the only way to actually save the internet, like truly save it, is to just completely destroy the one we have right now?
Right, it's just tear the whole thing down to the studs.
Exactly. Tear it down and replace it with basically a 10,000-year-old digital barter system.
Which, sounds pretty extreme at first.
It really does. I
Yeah.
mean, I want you to look at the device you are listening to this deep dive on right now. Whether it's your smartphone or a laptop, you are currently tethered to what? Dozens of massive corporate clouds.
Oh, easily dozens, probably more.
Right. You're on this multi-lane superhighway where everyone is connected to everyone else all the time. But today, we are talking about tearing down the corporate cloud.
Yeah, we're exploring a radically different architecture.
Totally. An internet that functions basically like an ancient human village where you only interact with the neighbors you explicitly personally trust.
It's a massive philosophical shift, honestly, and a structural one. We were just so conditioned to this idea of a frictionless, globally broadcast internet.
Yeah, where everything is just instantly everywhere.
Exactly. So the idea of scaling all of that back to a localized, consent-based village, it feels incredibly jarring at first. But when you look at the underlying mechanics, it actually solves some of the most complex security and privacy issues we face today.
And that is exactly our mission for this deep dive. We are unpacking a genuinely mind-bending April 2026 analyst report from Fred Cohen over at all.net.
It's a fascinating document.
It really is. He outlines this concept he calls a sovereign mesh system. So we're going to figure out how this hyper-localized architecture actually works without central servers and why the author argues we should intentionally build imperfect computers.
Which is a wild concept on its own.
Right. And we'll look at how this model could just completely change the way you control your digital life.
To really grasp why an engineer would even want to build a completely new internet from scratch, we kind of have to start by looking at the glaring vulnerabilities of the systems we currently rely on.
To ones we use every single day.
Exactly. The author actually traces the inspiration for this sovereign mesh all the way back to the ARPANET. Now, ARPANET was the precursor to the modern internet, and it was famously designed with one primary goal, which was to survive a nuclear attack.
Right, by being totally decentralized.
Yes, but the author takes that foundational idea of survivability and applies a biological lens to it, one that completely flips traditional computer science on its head.
Okay, wait, hold on. I need to stop you there because when I was reading that section of the source material, I completely tripped over a really counterintuitive point.
The part about viral environments.
Yes, the text explicitly says they like viral computing environments. They want to model the new internet on them.
I know, it sounds crazy.
It does. Usually, if I hear the words computer virus, it means my laptop is suddenly a very expensive brick. So why on earth would we intentionally use a viral environment as a blueprint for a secure digital future?
It sounds totally paradoxical, I know. But the author is applying evolutionary biology to digital networks. Think about how diverse biological life forms, including actual biological viruses, survive massive environmental catastrophes.
Okay, they survive because they evolve, right?
Exactly. They constantly evolve, and crucially, their populations are incredibly diverse.
Meaning, not every organism has the exact same vulnerability.
Precisely. In our current centralized computing paradigm, we have a massive lack of diversity. Millions of people use the exact same operating system.
Right, like Windows or Mac OS.
Yeah, with the exact same architecture connected to the exact same cloud servers. So if a hacker finds a single fundamental flaw in that uniform system,
They can just wipe out everything.
exactly, one attack can take down millions of machines simultaneously across the globe. In engineering, that's known as a common mode failure.
It's like having a master key that unlocks every single front door in a city. If a thief steals that one key, the whole city is compromised.
That's a great way to put it. But in a viral evolutionary computing environment, the systems are naturally varied. The environment itself might wipe out certain variants, but others survive precisely because they are slightly mutated and different from one another.
So they can't all be hacked the same way?
Right. If our digital devices are diverse and independent, a common mode failure simply isn't common enough to kill the whole network. The entire ecosystem becomes virtually indestructible through its sheer chaotic diversity.
Which perfectly sets up like the foundational pillar of this entire document, the concept of sovereignty. And when the author talks about sovereignty, they aren't just talking about you legally owning the physical hardware of your laptop.
No, it's much deeper than that.
Yeah, they are talking about absolute uncompromising authority.
Yes, Digital sovereignty in this mesh architecture means you possess absolute authority and complete fiduciary responsibility over your own system. It is a closed ecosystem built entirely on the principle of informed consent.
You set the rules.
You set the rules. Or, more likely, you have your personal, localized AI act as your digital steward to enforce those rules for you. But what really stands out in the report is how it defines the concept of trust to make all this work.
Oh, this part was wild.
Yeah, the author defines trust simply as your personal willingness to be harmed by another entity.
That is such a heavy philosophical definition for a computer science paper. Like, trust is your willingness to be harmed. I really had to sit with that for a minute.
It forces a total perspective shift.
It does, because right now, if you are downloading an app from a major tech company, you don't really trust them in a personal sense. You just blindly accept a 60-page terms of service agreement and, you know, hope their corporate security is good.
Right, you outsource the trust.
Exactly. But in this sovereign mesh, I am sitting in my own digital castle. I have pulled up the drawbridge. I am entirely cut off from the global internet, and I have to actively decide, am I willing to risk letting this specific person or this specific system into my castle?
It forces you to actively assess risk based on mutual history and relationship, mm-hmm. rather than relying on a third-party corporate guarantor. You only open the drawbridge for entities where the potential value of the interaction outweighs your willingness to endure potential harm.
But, I mean, if I play this out logically, it creates a massive logistical headache.
How so?
Well, if every single user is locked inside their own hyper-paranoid sovereign fortress, setting their own completely unique rules, and only trusting a tiny handful of friends, how does any actual work get done?
Right, the collaboration problem.
Yeah. If I need to collaborate on a project, how do our paranoid computers talk to each other without triggering all the alarms? I guess this is where the document introduces the concept of temporal microzones.
Yes, the temporal microzone is the author's solution to that exact problem.
When I read this part, the best way my brain could visualize it was like a digital flash mob or maybe a pop-up shop.
Oh, I like the pop-up shop idea.
Right. You have all these separate, highly guarded systems that agree to link arms completely temporarily, just long enough to pull off one specific task. And the second the task is done, the shop closes, the flash mob scatters, and the connections just vanish without a trace.
The pop-up shop is a brilliant way to visualize the temporary nature of it. The source material actually provides its own fantastic analogy to explain how the different parts work together, which is an open session at an after-hours jazz hangout.
That's a great image. But how does a digital jazz band actually play a song if they don't have a centralized conductor? Like, there's no global app store telling them what to do.
They do it through strictly standardized protocols and APIs, application programming interfaces. In the jazz analogy, the APIs are the sheet music and the underlying tempo.
So everyone knows the key they're playing in.
Exactly. The musicians are different computing mechanisms from completely different sovereign systems because they all know how to read the same standardized sheet music. They can show up, form a band to perform a specific song, execute the task flawlessly, and then immediately pack up their instruments and leave.
Just pack up and go.
Yep. The text refers to this temporary band as a temporal composite.
Okay, let's ground this for the listener. What does this digital jazz band actually look like for me, the user, sitting at my keyboard, trying to get my morning work done?
Well, to you, it looks entirely seamless. Let's say your morning work requires you to research a topic, write a complex piece of code, and pull up a historical document.
Okay, pretty standard morning.
Right. Your local AI, the one living on your sovereign machine, acts as the band leader. For the general research, your AI might temporarily connect to a remote public service, like a ChatGPT node.
Sure.
But let's say your research requires a completely uncensored, unfiltered response that a corporate AI won't provide.
Right, because corporate models have safety guardrails. They'll refuse to answer certain things.
Exactly. So your AI band leader drops the connection to ChatGPT and instead temporarily fuses with a local Ollama AI capability. A Llama is an open source AI model that can run locally.
So it's not relying on the cloud.
No, in this case, maybe it's running on the sovereign machine of a trusted friend who has permitted you access. Your system sends the prompt, grabs the uncensored output, and severs the link. Then for the coding portion, it might briefly link up with an Anthropic node.
And what about that historical document I needed?
The document details a process for this using something called a FUSE file system. FUSE stands for File System in User Space.
Let me see if I can translate that. Basically, FELI is a protocol that lets me access a folder of files that physically lives on a computer halfway across the country. But on my computer screen, it just looks like a normal yellow folder sitting right there on my desktop.
That is exactly what it does. It mounts a remote directory onto your local machine. So your Bandleader AI seamlessly reaches through that USC connection, grabs the document from a trusted collaborator's sovereign system, integrates it into your report, and then closes the door. Yeah, your system
Wow.
grabs compute power from over here, an AI from over there, a file from a friend, fuses them all together for 5 minutes to do the work, and then breaks the whole thing down.
And I don't see any of that chaos. I just see a unified screen on my end. It's incredibly elegant.
Right.
But, you know, trading storage for compute power and borrowing tools from friends requires our machines to physically discover each other.
Which brings up a massive logistical
A
challenge.
glaring question. A jazz band style of temporary connection sounds amazing, but without a centralized app store or a massive corporate search engine organizing the internet, how are these services actually discovered?
And how are they paid for?
Exactly. If I want to find a local fruit stand, I can't just open a centralized map app anymore. Does my system literally just shout out the window and ask the digital neighbors?
It quite literally asks the neighbors. And this is where the author brings in that deep historical context we touched on at the beginning. The text explicitly compares this modern mesh architecture to hominid interactions from roughly 150,000 years ago
Wow.
and to the early human villages that formed about 10,000 years ago.
It's a total regression. Like back before we had instant global broadcast capabilities where one person could shout to a billion people at once.
It is an intentional, strategic return to small group interactions. It replaces global commerce with a localized barter economy. Let's trace your fruit stand example exactly as the author describes the mechanism.
Okay, let's hear it.
You tell your sovereign AI that you want to buy some fresh fruit. Your AI looks around your specific localized mesh and queries the systems you have explicitly given it permission to talk to. It asks, "Hey, does anyone know a good fruit stand?"
And because every system sets its own rules, the responses are totally varied, right?
Right. Some neighbor systems will ignore your request entirely because they are busy computing something else. Some might only answer if their human owner considers you a close, high-trust friend.
Okay.
Others might have a rule to just answer any generic local query. Your AI aggregates the responses it gets from your trusted circle and presents you with the best answer.
And the kicker here is that there is no central credit card processor taking a 3% cut. It is purely digital bartering. The text has a great summary of this dynamic. You know how to fix a car, I know how to fix your system, it's a deal.
Yes. The exchange of value is entirely negotiated between the sovereign entities involved. You trade what you have for what you need. To illustrate this, the document provides a highly specific and frankly wonderful example involving a Dead Poets Society.
Yes. I loved this part. Let me try to break this one down because it perfectly captures how radically different a digital barter economy is from, say, paying Amazon Web Services a monthly subscription fee.
Go for it.
Okay, so the text says, imagine you want to build a highly complex RAG database. RAG stands for Retrieval Augmented Generation.
Right.
For the listener, if you aren't familiar with that term, it basically means taking an AI and feeding it a massive mountain of your own specific custom documents so the AI becomes an absolute expert on your personal data.
And importantly, synthesizing all of that custom data requires a tremendous amount of computational heavy lifting. It's very computationally expensive.
Exactly. My little laptop just can't handle it. In today's world, I'd rent server space from a giant corporation. But in this sovereign mesh, I strike a deal with a digital neighbor who has a massive, high-powered computing rig.
You barter with them.
I barter with them. I say, I need to borrow an hour of your heavy compute time to build my AI database. In exchange, I will grant you temporary FuSee access to my ultra-rare, meticulously organized subdirectories of ancient poetry readings.
It's amazing. You are literally trading digital favors based on personal relationships, mutual trust, and niche interests. It is a true peer-to-peer economy.
It sounds incredibly romantic, almost utopian, but let's be real for a second.
Right.
Relying on a patchwork of friends' machines, bartering for compute power, and constantly connecting and disconnecting, it sounds incredibly messy.
It is messy.
Which begs the question, if this system is so chaotic, how could it possibly defend itself against coordinated, state-sponsored cyber attacks or the rapid spread of malicious misinformation? We all know what a nightmare the current highly organized internet can be when it comes to bad actors.
It is the defining challenge of the system. And the author's solution to this defense problem is perhaps the most provocative part of the entire report. They argue that to achieve true security, we actually need to embrace imperfection.
Wait, hold on. I definitely need to push back here because this is where my brain almost broke reading the source text.
The quote about perfection.
Yes. There's a shocking quote in the document. Perfection is not our goal. Utility is. I thought the entire fundamental purpose of a computer was to be a flawless deterministic math machine. 1 + 1 always equals 2.
Usually.
So why on earth would we intentionally engineer an AI system that forgets things, or slightly alters information, or disobeys instructions, or acts passive-aggressive exactly like a flawed human being does?
Because in a decentralized mesh network, that precise imperfection is the ultimate defense mechanism.
Really? How?
The text explains the genius of this by describing how to build higher surety mesh networks out of low surety components. It all comes down to slowing the transitivity of information flow.
Transitivity meaning like how easily and quickly a piece of data can travel from point A to point Z across the network.
Correct. In a centralized system, high transitivity is the goal. Information moves at the speed of light to millions of people simultaneously.
Right.
But that is exactly what makes a virus or a piece of fake news so devastating. If you slow down that flow and introduce friction and slight distortion at every single node, you inherently protect the network. The author uses a brilliant analogy to explain this, the childhood game of telephone.
Oh, where you sit in a circle, whisper a phrase to the person next to you, and by the time it reaches the end of the circle, the phrase is completely garbled and distorted.
Exactly. Because this mesh system has no global broadcast capability, there's no one-to-many megaphone. Information has to travel peer-to-peer. Rumors, malicious code, or propaganda simply cannot maintain their narrative integrity as they travel across multiple sovereign borders.
Because it's getting slightly tweaked at every stop.
Right. The inherent imperfections of the intermediary nodes naturally degrade the malicious signal.
Because the virus can't just post a link on a global timeline. It has to physically convince one computer to accept it, and then that computer has to try and convince the next computer down the line.
Right. And it's even harder than that because every sovereign node is equipped with its own internal cannon. The author spells this C-A-N-N-O-N, acting as a baseline or canon of truth for that specific user.
Oh, interesting.
This canon constantly monitors incoming information and checks it for consistency, heavily weighting it against the mutual historical relationship you share with the sender.
Okay, so if my digital neighbor and I have a 5-year history of strictly trading ancient poetry files, and suddenly their system tries to send me a highly aggressive executable file that wants to scan my hard drive, my system's canon looks at the context and says, whoa, this is wildly out of character for the poetry guy, and automatically drops the drawbridge and shuts them out.
Exactly. It functions as a contextual cognitive filter, much like human intuition. And this makes systematic, widespread disruption incredibly difficult. A hacker cannot simply discover one zero-day exploit and conquer the network.
Because every network is different.
Right. As the text vividly lays out, an attacker has to compromise the network one friend at a time. It requires an astronomical amount of time and effort to build the requisite historical trust with each individual sovereign node just to get past their specific front door.
I love the imagery the document uses here. A lie can no longer spread halfway around the world before the truth gets its pants on.
It's a great line.
Because the lie keeps getting detained and interrogated at the digital border of every single new village it tries to enter. But for the tech-savvy listeners out there, how does this stealth actually work under the hood? If my computer is connected to a network, how is it hiding from the millions of automated hacker bots scanning the internet every second?
The document details some rigorous technical stealth mechanisms. The author explains that these sovereign endpoints sit completely hidden behind NAT gateways.
Okay, let's translate that. A NAT gateway is essentially a digital bouncer. It masks your specific private IP address from the wild public internet, so anyone looking from the outside just sees the bouncer, not the people inside the club.
Exactly. And furthermore, these systems are configured to block absolutely all incoming traffic except what is known as local host traffic.
Uh-huh.
In networking, that is the 127.0.0.1 address.
Meaning the computer is basically programmed to only look in the mirror. It literally only talks to itself and ignores everyone else.
It drops everything else. It has no open services running to the outside world. It doesn't even respond to a basic ping to confirm it's turned on.
Wow.
To a hacker scanning the web, your sovereign machine functionally does not exist. It is a black hole. It only initiates outbound communication on its own strict terms.
But wait, if everyone is a black hole, how do two friends ever find each other to trade poetry?
Ah, well, when two sovereign systems do agree to connect, they use highly unpredictable prearranged methods. The text compares it to the radio frequency shifting used in secure military communications, where the transmission constantly hops between different radio dials.
So you can't just lock onto it.
Right. It's not a static web address you can bookmark and attack later. It is a highly specific, synchronized agreement. For example, the systems might agree. I will meet you at IP address 197.62.57.89 on UDP port 22341 tomorrow, exactly at 1709 Pacific time.
It's a digital dead drop. You meet in a dark alley at exactly midnight, swap the briefcases, and vanish back into the shadows. It is intensely secure precisely because it is so fragmented, temporary, and unpredictable.
It really is.
So if we take a step back and look at the whole picture, what we are exploring here isn't just a technical blueprint for a new type of router or software update. This is a massive fundamental shift in our relationship with technology.
It really is a total paradigm shift.
It's about consciously choosing to trade the frictionless convenience of a mass global broadcast for the safety, the accountability, and the true digital sovereignty of a localized peer-to-peer mesh.
It is a profound trade-off, but arguably a necessary one. We are currently living in a world defined by overwhelming information overload, massive algorithmic manipulation, and the homogenization of culture, dictated by a handful of massive tech platforms.
Yeah, everything feels the same now.
Exactly. This sovereign architecture offers a tangible, engineered way to take back total control. You, and only you, decide exactly who gets to speak to your system, what AI tools you use to interpret the world, and what your digital environment ultimately looks like.
It's about ripping the power out of the massive corporate data centers and putting it squarely back onto the hard drive sitting on your desk.
Right where it belongs.
But, you know, as I was reading through this vision of perfectly guarded, hyper-localized villages, I couldn't help but feel a little bit of friction. A catch, you know.
The downside to all that security.
Yeah. And this brings us to a lingering question I want to leave you with today, building right on the text's core theme of restriction and filtering.
What's the question?
Well, if we actually pull this off, if you successfully retreat into your sovereign microzone, only ever interacting with the handful of people you explicitly trust, and strictly filtering out the rest of the noisy, chaotic world,
yeah.
Do we accidentally destroy the serendipity of the global internet?
Oh, that's a really interesting point.
In our noble, necessary quest for perfect digital safety and narrative integrity, returning to the digital equivalent of a 10,000-year-old human village, do we permanently lose the magic of stumbling upon a brilliant, life-changing idea from a complete and total stranger?
It's definitely a risk we'd be taking.
Something to mull over the next time you log on.